This is a special GLT Sound Ideas broadcast of a town hall meeting at Illinois Wesleyan University conducted by U.S. Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois. He's the number two Democrat in the Senate. We're at Westbrook Auditorium in Presser Hall on campus. There's the music building at ISU. I'm Charlie Schlenker. As we wait for Senator Durbin to take the microphone, he's being introduced right now by Illinois Wesleyan University Professor Eric Jensen. It's worth noting this is a sold-out event. Tickets were free, but space was limited. All available slots were snapped up very quickly, and we saw a long line of people waiting patiently to get in to fill the house size of about 550 people. Town hall meetings have become a hot-button issue in the last couple months as the House has ramped up to try to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Durbin got a huge cheer as he walked on stage, and here we have Senator Dick Durbin.
Thanks, everybody. Thank you. It is it's great to be back at Wesleyan. I was here a few months ago. We've had some of my outstanding staffers who have graduated from Wesleyan, and I have a fond place in my heart for this great school and the people who attend and teach. And, Mr. President, thank you. He did tell me, coincidentally, just a minute ago as we were standing in the wings, he said, "Where'd you get that tie?" And I said, he said, "The tie bar?" And I said, "Yes, as a matter of fact, I did." And he said, "Illinois Wesleyan grad." Very proud of it. So let me give a plug for the tie bar. Online, make sure you pay your sales tax. So, good news this afternoon in Washington. It was good news for a million people in Illinois who are about to lose their health insurance. It was good news for 5,000 hospital workers at the hospitals in these two congressional districts that share Bloomington. And if you want to put 5,000 jobs in perspective, that represents all of the jobs of Caterpillar in this region of our state. That's how important this vote was when it came to Illinois jobs. It was good news for the disabled, because many of them need continuing care. It was good news for hospitals across the board that are trying their best to keep their doors open, particularly downstate small-town hospitals. And I have a warm spot in my heart for them. I hope you do too. Because for many of these communities, these are not only a lifeline, these are the best-paying jobs in their community. And if they lose the hospital, keeping the jobs is more difficult. And certainly losing those hospital jobs is painful. I can go across the board and down the litany of all the different groups that were advantaged by this today, but I want to start with a basic premise, and that is, what is the difference between the two political parties when they discuss this issue? And I'll start with a personal story that kind of explains where I'm coming from. If you have ever been a father of a sick child and didn't have health insurance, you'll never forget it as long as you live. My wife and I made a very smart financial decision. I waited until she was 21 to marry her. I was the ripe age of 22, and I was in law school. And we went off to Washington, where I was attending law school, second year, and God sent us a little baby right away. Beautiful little girl with a major medical problem. We had no health insurance. And I was faced with getting through law school, feeding my family, and dealing with this as a law student between my second and third year in school. And without health insurance, this is what it meant. I had to skip class, get in my little Volkswagen Bug, and drive my wife and little girl to Children's Hospital in Washington, D.C. And we would go to the charity ward because we had no insurance. And they would give us a number, and we would wait till our number was called. Someone in a white coat would walk through a door and say, number 26. And Loretta and I would grab our little girl and head into an examining room, praying to God that whoever was in that room in that white coat knew what they were talking about and could save my little girl's life with no health insurance. If you've ever been through that once in your life, you'll never forget it the rest of your life. I never have. And I came to believe, and I think many people agree, health care is not a privilege. It is a right in America. We don't argue that point when it comes to those over the age of 65 in Medicare, do we? We basically say, at that point, you're entitled to health care protection. There was an article you might have seen in the New York Times last weekend, and it was about the disease of cystic fibrosis. And it said, it compared the survival rates for cystic fibrosis, a terrible disease, a challenging disease, the survival rates in Canada and the United States of America. The difference, in Canada, you live to be 50 years old on average before passing. In the United States, 40. 10 years difference? Why? They did an analysis, and there were different things the way we handled such things as lung transplants. But the bottom line was health insurance. The bottom line is, and it's approved by 91% of the people in Canada, the bottom line was you have the confidence of health insurance in Canada, and many people don't in the United States. So when I voted for the Affordable Care Act about 7 years ago this week, it was with the knowledge that we would reduce the number of people without health insurance. We wouldn't get to zero. There are problems, undocumented and so forth, working them into our legal system of laws and so forth. But we would reduce it, and we did, to the lowest percentage uninsured in modern history, in history, in America. Now, this debate we've been going through for the past several weeks since the new Republican Congress is one that we all saw coming. Because almost from the beginning, without a single Republican vote to support the Affordable Care Act, they have been bound and determined to repeal it. An interesting thing happened. We tried to sell the Affordable Care Act on its merits, and people were yawning and saying, talk to me later, Senator. I've got things to worry about. They're basketball games. But when the Republicans suggested they were going to repeal it, things changed. People said, wait a minute, what are you taking away? You're taking away my protection when it comes to someone with pre-existing conditions in my household. You are taking away my protection of my health insurance when it comes to lifetime limits. You are taking away my protection as a woman not to be discriminated against when it comes to premiums paid for health insurance. The list goes on. And going on, this list basically defines what we consider to be basic insurance protection. Now, it's interesting to listen to the debate on the other side, and it goes something like this. Hey, I'm a red-blooded man. Why in the heck should I have to pay for prenatal care for some woman? Huh? And you think to yourself, well, isn't there an argument, red-blooded man, that she's not going to get prostate cancer? And she's paying for your medical care. And aren't we describing what an insurance pool is all about? An insurance pool of healthy and sick people that covers virtually an array of possibilities that none of us know about our own lives and our own families. What will happen tomorrow? And that is what we tried to do. Make sure the health insurance that you bought was worth paying for, and to make sure as well that the number of people who had access to it was substantial. 19 Republican governors refused to extend Medicaid protection under the Affordable Care Act. So when many Republican congressmen criticized the Congressional Budget Office, oh, they get their numbers wrong. Congressional Budget Office didn't think there was a sensible governor alive who wouldn't expand Medicaid if the federal government paid for it. 19 Republicans did not. Incidentally, Governor Pence of Indiana did. But the point I'm getting to is that we had more and more Americans with that opportunity. Two quick stories. First, Judy. Judy is almost a celebrity in my office because they've told this story so often. We met Judy down in Marion, Illinois, at a motel where I stay, and she was a hospitality lady. You get up in the morning, and there's that nice little breakfast there. You know, you get to make that waffle, and it flips over and all the rest of that. And Judy was the hospitality lady there, and a nice lady she was, a sweetheart of a lady. We got to be friends. And finally, Judy said to me one day, she said, "Senator, I'm really worried about this Obamacare. They tell me that it's going to cost me a lot of money." And I said, "Well, why don't you sit down with my staff here and figure out what would happen to you if it became the law?" And that's when we discovered something. 62-year-old Judy had worked all of her life, usually more than one job at a time, had never had health insurance one day in her life. Never. She was 62. And because she worked 25 to 30 hours a week in the hospitality industry, she didn't make a lot of money. But she always showed up on time. And it turned out, when it was all said and done, her income was so low, she qualified for Medicaid, which basically meant that she did not have to pay for her health insurance. She couldn't believe it. But that is what the Affordable Care Act said. Lucky for her. She signed up, got into Medicaid, and within a year was diagnosed with diabetes. So thank goodness she had a medical home and a doctor and somebody to care for her as she approached Medicare and approached the coverage that she needed. The second person was Ray Romanowski. If that sounds like a Chicago name, it is. Ray Romanowski is a big old fella who's a musician, plays a guitar. And I ran into him and he said, "Musicians never have health insurance." He said, "I'm playing my gigs and doing my thing, and I never did. And now I'm in my 60s, Senator, but I got it now." He got his Medicaid. So these are examples from one end of our state to another, of people who finally got this protection. The last point I want to make before I open it to questions is this. Here's what I want to take away from today. We're now at a full stop when it comes to the debate on the Affordable Care Act. Where do we go next? Here's what I've said, and I think most Democrats would agree. If you take repeal off the table, I'm pulling up a chair to that table. I'm ready to sit down. I'm willing to sit down. I'm willing to sit down and to concede it is not a perfect law. As I've said, some of you have heard it, the only perfect law was carried down the side of a mountain by Senator Moses on clay tablets. So far, we're trying to aspire to that level. We haven't quite reached it. And if I sat down, I'll tell you what I'd put on the table as a Democrat. I know the Republicans would put some things on as well. Two things I'd put on the table. The first thing I'd put on the table is a public option, so that there's a Medicare for all option. Medicare is trusted. It has proven itself. It would be it wouldn't be the Medicare plan, but one just like it. We keep Medicare for the elderly and disabled, but we'd have one just like it as an option everywhere in the country, if that's where you want to go. It's a not-for-profit operation with Medicare standards and Medicare reimbursement. I think that ought to be in every place. The second thing I'd put on the table, pharmaceuticals. I want to tell you, I'm not telling you any secrets because this has all been published. The pharmaceutical industry played us like a fiddle when we passed the Affordable Care Act and made sure that there was little or no regulation of their industry. The net result of it is pharmaceutical prices are out of control. Don't take my word for it. Ask Blue Cross Blue Shield up in Chicago. They will tell you, as they've told me, that last year they spent more money on pharmaceuticals than inpatient hospital care. You don't think it's out of control? Turn on your TV if you don't think it's out of control. Try to get through an hour or two, at least when most seniors are still awake. Try to get through an hour or two without being barraged with all these new drugs for all these new situations. And I love the warnings. Don't you just love the warnings? My favorite is, "And if you've had a liver transplant, be sure and tell your doctor." Doc, did I mention... Oh, you saw that incision, yes. Only two countries in the world allow pharmaceutical companies to advertise direct to consumers. We're one of them. And what does it do? It leads many people to finally, the third time, write out the name of that drug, which is hard to pick out the first time, and walk into a doctor's office and hand them the name of that drug and say, "Doctor, I've got psoriasis, and I'd like to take this drug." I just had the head of the Chicago Medical Society, a dermatologist, told me that the psoriasis drugs that are being advertised are $20,000 to $50,000 a year. Now, if you have a rough spot on your elbow, and some of us do, I wish I didn't have it. It's not going to help me when they have the Speedo contest, but it's it's not going to change my life. Now, on the other hand, there are people with serious problems with psoriasis, and $20,000 to $50,000 may be the way they need, what they need to reclaim their lives. But the point is, these names are being brought to the doctor's office, prescriptions are being written. It is quicker to write a prescription, hand it to them, and leave than to spend 10 or 15 minutes explaining, this may not be the right thing for you at this point. And so we see the cost of pharmaceuticals going up. We need to do things that make sense. I still cannot explain, nor defend, nor will I try, why the same drug made by the same company sold in Canada sells at a fraction of the cost. Why? You know why? Because the Canadian government cares. They care enough to say to the pharmaceutical companies, a reasonable profit, but don't go crazy. If you do, we're going to take you off our list. And the pharmaceutical companies listen. We need to do more like that. So those are the two things Durbin would put on the table, and now you get to put things on the table. So the way this works, it's like a drawing, and I want to make sure that they don't think I've stacked the audience. So they want to? Okay. All right. All right, hang on. I'm going to rearrange this. Okay? Cool. If I call your name and you want to ask a question, come to the rows, the center here, the aisles, and they'll come up to you and they'll hold the microphone so you don't run away with it. And the only rules are, I'm going to mention your name, but if you repeat your name and where you're from, the only other rule is if you want to give a speech, you got to run for the Senate. So try to make it a real question, if you will. And the first two people up are going to be Kathleen Winters and Gail Stanek. Come on over here, come toward the aisle, and I'll get two more ready in the wings. How's that? Boy, Kai,
Senator Dick
me
Durbin
if I don't
starting
correctly.
To take questions from the audience here. This is Sound Ajay. Ideas. I'm Charlie Close. Schlenker, and we're coming to you from Illinois Wesleyan University's Presser Hall in a live town hall meeting on health care. By Democrat Dick Durbin, U.S. Senator from Illinois.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Winters. I'm from Urbana.
Yep.
And thanks so much for the work you do on our behalf. I wanted to ask a question about the Supreme Court confirmation. And I know this is a veer off from healthcare, but I guess I'm concerned about the filibuster strategy, and if you could explain a little bit more about why you guys think that's the way to go. I'm worried about the nuclear option and future vacancies and how what we'll do then.
This is a very well-read audience, if you're any indication, Kathleen. So I spent a better part of 3 days in a room with Judge Neil Gorsuch, 10th Circuit, aspiring to the Supreme Court. First day, we got to give speeches to him. He gave one back to us. Next day, questions from early morning till late at night. Third day, public panel on this. And some of you watched, I'm sure, drew your own impression of the judge. He was careful not to say a lot of things to commit himself. That's nothing new. Many nominees have done the same, Democrats and Republicans. And so the question comes down to several things. From my point of view, how did he get here? How did Neil Gorsuch end up being Donald Trump's Supreme Court nominee in this early stage of his presidency? Well, we know, and it's been admitted, the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation, two conservative Republican organizations, produced a list which Donald Trump published in his campaign of 21 names, and included in the names were Neil Gorsuch as a possible Supreme Court nominee. This happens, of course, in a situation where many of us remember what happened to this vacancy last year. When Antonin Scalia passed away, President Obama used his constitutional authority and responsibility to nominate Merrick Garland, and Mitch McConnell announced that for the first time in history, they would not give, the Republican majority in the Senate would not give the president nominee a hearing or a vote. In fact, McConnell went a step further and said, I won't even meet with him. It was a break in the tradition and precedent of the Senate, and many of us believe that it really challenged the basis of the Constitution. In other words, we'll just wait around and see if we can take the presidency. Well, they did. And at the end of last year, when Mitch McConnell closed down the Senate, he also closed down the executive calendar with 30 names on it of judges to fill judicial vacancies across the United States, all of which had been reported by a bipartisan vote out of the Senate Judiciary Committee. So here we are, brand new, first up to bat, the Supreme Court vacancy, and Gorsuch being suggested. The Supreme Court is the only thing left at cabinet level and similar levels where the filibuster can apply, which means you can debate it, and it takes 60 votes to stop the debate and call for a vote. And we know, because we used it, that you can use the vice president and the chair to change the rules and eliminate that so that it's no longer there and a simple majority is all you need for the Supreme Court. So you look back in precedent, and at least recent precedent is that you can't make it on the court without at least 60 votes in the Senate. Every nominee, two by President Obama, Sotomayor and Kagan, and two by President Bush, Roberts and Alito, had at least 60 votes. Asterisk, Alito was a procedural motion, cloture vote, with more than 70 votes. But all of them had at least 60 on their path to the Supreme Court. So for us to insist that a lifetime appointment on the highest court should require 60 to show bipartisan support is not a break with tradition at all. We gave this man a hearing, as we promised, and we gave him a vote, as we promised. The standard we're using is one that's been used for Democratic nominees as well. We do run the risk, as Kathleen noted, that they could blow the top off of it in terms of eliminating the filibuster for the Supreme Court nominee. There is some resistance to that on the Republican side. There are a few of them who said they don't want to see that tradition completely destroyed. Whether they'll stick with us in the end, I don't know. Some people have said, well, why don't you cut a big deal? Big deal. Just won't be Gorsuch on Scalia's seat. It'll be whenever the Democratic seats, if any of them, open up, what will the standard be there as well? Some people in our caucus are skeptical about cutting deals with Senator McConnell after what we went through with Mr. Garland. So stay tuned. This has not been decided. Who was next? Stanek. Right?
Oh.
That's you.
I'm Gail Stanek, and I have a bit of a laryngitis problem, so I hope you can hear me.
I'll try.
I have 15 grandchildren and seven
Good
great-grandchildren,
for you.
And that's why I'm here. I'm here to represent them. I listened to a lot of the television today, and of course, he who shall not be named, when he did get on with his videotape message, of course, he blamed you, not personally, but you and Mr. Schumer and all the Democrats for what happened. And first of all, I'd like you and all the senators in the Democrat side to shake the hands of those 35 congressmen who stood up to the bullying and the wheeling and dealing and thoughts of murder or whatever they were given. But this has been going on a long time. You talked about your child. In 1995, my 20-year-old son had a heart attack. We had insurance through my company. And I know I'm giving a speech. I'm so sorry, but invested in this problem. He was the youngest person at St. Joseph's Hospital, and the doctor wanted to do one more test, and of course you had to verify it with the insurance company, and they said no. They don't want to pay for any more. And I went hysterical, crying. He was going to die, and she put her hands on my shoulder and shook me, and she said, Gail, insurance companies are not here to help you. They're here to make money. And I hope when you Democrats are able to sit down and look at this Affordable Care Act that they won't even let their own Republicans look at, phase 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, take out that $1 trillion tax break that is going to pharmaceutical companies and insurance companies and give it to the people. Can you promise me that you will all work hard to cut these tax breaks to these companies that are really in it to make money?
Well, I'm not sure. When it comes to tax breaks for insurance companies and pharmaceuticals, but I will tell you, I mean, I'm not sure exactly what you're pointing to, and I want to know what that means. But I will tell you this. I understand the science of insurance. I think we all do. And we understand they are profit-making companies. What we tried to do was to limit the premiums they charge in the Affordable Care Act and to say that 85% of the premiums collected had to be spent on actual medical care. And that was a reform built into it. They didn't like that much. They didn't like to be told what was in their insurance policies. But we did. And I think we've got to continue to monitor this very closely. I'd like to debunk one or two myths that are out there that you hear constantly. I've heard this from the junior senator from Texas, Senator Cruz. He said, if you just let us buy insurance across state lines, there'd be real competition. Well, it turns out, guess what? The federal government has no prohibition on your buying insurance across state lines. The problem comes in because insurance is regulated by the states. So he needs to address that to a lot of governors and legislatures. The second problem is, what if I do spot that real bargain in health insurance in the state of Alabama and decide I'm going to buy my family's protection in Illinois in Alabama? What did I just buy? Probably access to certain Alabama hospitals and certain Alabama doctors' practices will be preferred. Otherwise, I pay more out of pocket. And these insurance companies manufacture or devise these insurance policies based on geography and where you live. So they'll start having an out-of-state policy. And what if I'm mistreated in Alabama? What if I'm not treated fairly? When this Illinois resident calls the insurance commissioner of Alabama, how much do you think they'll pay attention to me? So some of these things are just fraudulent in terms of what they're supposed to do. When it comes to pharmaceuticals, I tried to address that earlier. I want them to be profitable. I want them to research. I want them to find the new cures. But they spend more on advertising than they spend on research. And I want to make sure that if we are going to give them a tax break for their advertising, maybe that's what you were referring to, tax break for the advertising, that's going to come to an end. As far as I'm concerned, that is not informing consumers. It is, in fact, bludgeoning consumers into putting pressure on doctors, and it's just running up the cost of the system. Kai, pronounce your last name again.
Ajayi.
What is it?
Ajayi.
Wow.
You want to try?
Gotcha. Gotcha.
Ajayi. So I live in Bloomington. I actually teach here at Wesleyan. Of all the industrialized nations on the planet, we are number one. We know this because we're number one in GDP. You look at social progress, we're not in the top 20. We look at things like infant mortality, we're not in the top 20. We look at the happiness index, which was just published recently. We dropped from 14 to 16. So we've got all the money, but for some reason we're not healthy, we're not happy, and Lord knows we're not educated. So the question I have for you, sir, specifically relates to healthcare and education. I've heard you talk about the public option, but if we look at our compatriots in the Western world, all of them have one thing in common, universal health care. When might we be able to see that? And also our K-12 education in particular is suffering. We look at our higher education in the sciences. They're mostly foreign-born students who are occupying those spaces. So question number one, where do you see us going on universal health care? And number two, what in the world are we going to do about education?
Thanks, Kai. And good question. Kathy O'Gorman, get up to bat. Amy Wood and Robert Naiman, while I answer Kai. I think this is, where'd you go, Kai? There you are. I think my impression is this is the last chance for private insurance. This is it. We have basically said we'll devise a plan to try to cover America that is based grounded on private insurance companies. And we want to see if this works. If it doesn't, I think the next step is obvious. We have to move, as other countries have, to a universal health care system. And as I mentioned before, the Canadians seem to love theirs, and their health results are better than ours in a lot of instances. So we aren't asking people to sacrifice much. But this was our last try at a hybrid system. 60% or 63-4% are in private insurance, another 35% or so are in government types of insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, Veterans Administration, Indian health care, children's health insurance programs. So this is our last chance at that. And it is a tough battle. You look at the Congress as it's composed today, and I don't see a path towards universal health care with the current Congress anywhere soon. But, you know, we've got to be honest about this. If we start with the premise that I started with, that health care is a right, then we can't stop. You could never accept losing 24 million people insured. Second question again, Kai?
Education,
K-12. Well, you sure give me a tough one there. Because, by and large, we provide such a tiny percentage of the money for education, public education at the federal level. It is primarily state and local, and you know the mess we have in our state. I just want to say a word here, and I'm not going to be political at all about this, but it just is heartbreaking for me to meet with leaders from all over our state and hear what they are going through, particularly university towns, and Bloomington-Normal is an exception. Most of the university towns downstate are struggling. Their economies are struggling because their universities are struggling. And to allow this state to go on 2 years without a budget is obscene. And I will tell you, we will not turn the corner toward economic growth in this state until we get the mess in Springfield straightened out. And it is going to be painful as hell. The solutions are going to involve taxes and cuts, and we're not going to like any of them. But suck it up, my friends. We've got to get through this so we can at least say to the next generation, we're going to give you a fighting chance. And when it comes to funding education, you know, I happen to believe that that's the best investment you make. But we have to acknowledge some realities. There are some young people in neighborhoods in our state who need more than just a good modern school. They need a mentor, a helping hand, some guidance through some very difficult times in life. I had a press conference last Sunday with Danny Davis up in Chicago, and I was inspired by it because of the heartbreaking gun violence in Chicago. My wife and I watched a 60-minute show, you probably saw it, about Chicago, and it was horrible. Horrible, what they said about that great city, and I'm so honored to represent, the gun violence and the police, who are basically sitting on their hands saying, we'll respond to calls as we receive them. And the net result of it was just, I didn't know what to say. My wife turned to me and said, somebody ought to do something. And I said, I guess I'm a somebody. And so what I did was to try to say, I've got to find an angle or a part of this that others may not have seen. And what I found was, others have seen this, but I'm trying to make it a major point, is 92% of the adolescents at the Cook County Juvenile Facility waiting trial, and if you're waiting trial, it's because of a serious felony charge, 92% of them have either been victims of trauma or witnessed violent trauma. Think about the money we spend when our soldiers come back, having been trained for battle, going into battle with their units, with commanders watching them, counseling them, helping them, and still need help from post-traumatic stress disorders. And we give them that help, thank goodness, and we should. What about a six-year-old who goes through the same thing and now is standing there by himself or herself? I went to Pilsen, and I went into an all-Hispanic school, and I talked to a mom. The father came down the stairs in front of the mother and two kids and took his life. And the kids were little, 5 and 7, and saw this. They didn't want to go to school. They didn't want to talk to anybody, nothing. They put him into trauma counseling, and I got to sit down with those kids later. They didn't know that I knew the whole story, but their lives were back. They were moving in the right direction. So when it comes to school, you bet, the best in education. But when it comes to raising these kids in a way where you can hope that they have some hope in their lives and some possibilities. There's a spectrum of opportunity and a spectrum of responsibility there. Thanks, Kai. It's a good question. Okay. We're going up to the suites upstairs, the executive suites.
Thank you. I want to thank you for all you've done for us, Senator. You've been terrific. And now I want to ask you what we can do, because there are so many activists locally, and we get information about making phone calls, about sending postcards, and I don't know what's really effective. I have a particular concern for our immigrant communities, and we're living in a particularly... in a particularly distressing time, and it is, I hope, just a mean time, but it's a very mean, mean time, and they are under terrible, terrible distress, whether it is the immediate undocumented families, families who are documented, or those of us who are their friends and neighbors and community members. And I'm wondering if you have suggestions for what would be effective for any and all of us.
Let me address the immigration issue first and then talk about what we can do. I come to this issue with prejudice. My mother was an immigrant to this country. She was brought here at the age of two from Lithuania, and with her brother and sister and my grandmother. And they caught the train, and Lithuanians caught the Baltimore and Ohio train in Baltimore and had two destination choices. My grandfather had chosen the St. Louis choice instead of the Chicago choice, and that's why I ended up growing up in East St. Louis, in the Lithuanian community. East St. Louis? Whoa! I tell that story because if you ever visit my office in Washington, right behind me on my credenza is my mother's naturalization certificate. And it's a reminder to every visitor to this office that I'm first-generation American and damn proud of it. And I think my family story is the American story. People who came here with nothing and showed real courage to get on that boat and come over to a place where they didn't even speak the language and decided to sacrifice everything so the kids might have a better chance in life. That's the story of this country, and it continues to be the story of this country. There's a special gene in these immigrants, a courage gene that says, I'm going to try my best, and I'm going to bet it all, bet everything, give up everything to do just that. What is going on now with immigration in this country is disgraceful. It is disgraceful. And I want to tell you why. I hope everyone here agrees, and I think we all do agree, we want no one who is criminally dangerous to be on the streets of this country. We want them in jail or out of this country, period. Put that over here. But we're not talking about criminally dangerous people here. We're talking about people who are being deported for traffic offenses. We're talking about people who are being harassed and followed now. It is not something that we should be proud of as a nation. 2 weeks ago, I was in Chicago at Sidley Austin, pretty big law firm. I could never interview there, but pretty big law firm. And they had their pro bono day, and I gave a little speech. And I said to one of the pro bono lawyers, what you working on? Oh, he said, 50 of us are going over to Immaculate Conception Church in Brighton Park in Chicago on Saturday. We have several hundred people who need our legal services. I said, several hundred? What's it for? He said, these are families that are coming in and asking us to draw up guardianship papers, because one of the parents is undocumented, and they think could be snatched up and deported, maybe even others in the house deported. Then who's going to take care of the kids? We've got to pick who's going to take care of the kids and write it down so it's a legal document. Could you imagine, as a mother or father, anticipating that possibility and carrying on with life? Let me take you to another group. I introduced the DREAM Act 16 years ago. And the DREAM Act... That looks like a mayor. Hi, Terry. They know you. You know what the DREAM Act was all about. Brought here as a kid, finished high school, no criminal issues, give you a chance, legal status, and citizenship. That's what the bill said. Couldn't pass it. Passed it once in the Senate. Passed it once in the House. Couldn't pass it. Make it law. President Obama, I wrote him a letter, said, think about something you might be able to do since you co-sponsored the DREAM Act as a senator. And he did. He came up with DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. And if the young person could come up with $500, go through a background check, criminal background check, and an interview, they could be approved to stay here for 2 years at a time, renewable. While they're here, wouldn't be deported, and they had the legal right to work. That's what it basically came down to. Over 750,000 have signed up. 750,000 across this country. And some of them are the most amazing stories you can imagine, what they've been able to achieve. There may be some of them at your university here. It's entirely possible. But what they've done is to prove my point. Given a chance, they can make a dramatic improvement in this world. So what can you do? What can I do? Tell their stories. Tell their stories. Jack Valenti used to work for LBJ. And he used to say, every good speech has six words in it. Let me tell you a story. In West Frankfort, Illinois, an undocumented man who owned a Mexican restaurant was deported. The whole community stood up and said, this is wrong. He is a pillar of our community, and the fact he doesn't have the right legal papers shouldn't be a reason to tear his family apart and close down his good little Mexican restaurant, which we all love in West Frankfort. And they all mobilized behind him, all the clubs and all the businesses, and they saved him. They turned it around and brought him back. They told a story, and it was in the papers there and the New York Times. So tell your story. Last point is, what can we do? I have one word for you. Elections. Now, in a democracy, we know what we need to do. We need to find good candidates who share our values and support them. And that means if you got some money, you share it. If you don't have some money, you bet you have some time. If you don't have some time, you may have a Facebook page. You may have some friends. There are lots of things that you can do. And so we need to encourage good candidates to come forward. And there's an effort underway, and stay tuned, okay? Yes.
This is Sound Ideas, a broadcast of U.S. Senator Dick Durbin's town hall meeting at Illinois Wesleyan University.
And my question for you, as someone who's inside the Senate, what will it take? What lines need to be crossed for McConnell, Ryan, to call for an independent investigation on the Trump-Pence campaign? I know your colleagues, Senators Graham and McCain, have called for an independent investigation. Do you see other Republicans starting to crack? And that's what I want to know.
I'm going to answer that as Sarah Keene and Gant Wallet. Wallet? Did I do that right? Wallet? Gant? Grant? No penmanship award for you, Graham. Okay, what happened last Monday? Something historic. The director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation testified under oath before the House Intelligence Committee that an investigation was underway to determine, it did two things, investigation underway to determine whether there was any connection between the Russian interference in our presidential campaign and the Trump campaign. It was as plain as that. He went on to say, and there is no evidence that Barack Obama or anyone wiretapped Donald Trump. So, this is a big deal. When I first got elected to the United States Senate, they appointed me to the Government Affairs Committee. And Fred Thompson, some of you remember from television, reverse mortgage guy, Fred Thompson was the chairman, John Glenn the co-chair. How about that? We spent months in public hearings investigating whether the Chinese government influenced the Clinton-Gore campaign. What was this based on? Some dumb stunt where they collected checks from Buddhist nuns for the Clinton-Gore campaign. What were they thinking? Anyway, we went on for months because we wanted to know what the Chinese were up to. And then published our report and hearing when it was over. The Republicans were in control in those days. I don't want to make light of that, but I do want to put it in perspective. This is much, much more serious. 14 intelligence agencies have told us it happened. The Russians invaded the voter file of the state of Illinois. We know that. We know as well what they were trying to do throughout this campaign. and it is serious business. I've said from the start we need a bipartisan, independent, transparent commission to get to the bottom of this. And so that there's no question that Durbin's trying to stack the deck, how about General Colin Powell and Sandra Day O'Connor co-chairing it? You know. But it is growing. The force behind it is growing. John McCain, thank goodness, and Lindsey Graham, both friends, have stepped up, and I think more will step up as this unfolds. So I certainly support it. In the meantime, we need a special prosecutor. I am glad that Attorney General Sessions recused himself. He should have, because he didn't answer, at least completely, if not honestly, the question that Al Franken asked. So that was a good reason for him to step aside in this situation. I think it's a serious matter. Let the chips fall where they may. If it doesn't involve Donald Trump, if it doesn't involve the key people in his campaign, so be it. But let's serve notice on Vladimir Putin that the next election will not be his playground either. So next.
Yes? Hi.
This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Thank you for voting no on the Iraq War. Thank you for your advocacy for diplomacy with Iran and everything you did in public and behind the scenes to support the Iran nuclear deal. I'm very concerned about U.S. support for the Saudi war in Yemen. I'm very concerned about the United Nations famine warning for Yemen and the Red Cross, and particularly the blockade, the Saudi blockade at Hodeidah, which the UN and the aid groups say is the thing that could tip Yemen into famine with hundreds of thousands of Yemeni children at risk of starvation. 10 senators yesterday sent a letter to Tillerson, bipartisan senator, saying we need a diplomatic surge within weeks in order to save Yemen from famine. I wonder what you can do using your leverage with the Saudis publicly and privately. Trump wants to sell them more weapons. That's an opportunity for Congress and the Senate to exert leverage. What can you do to stop the famine in Yemen and open up a Hodeidah to humanitarian aid, the Red Cross?
Thanks. And first on Iran, we had a closed-door meeting with the Secretary General of the IAEA. His last name is Amano. He's a Japanese individual, and he has had this job for quite a few years. And we asked pointed questions about this was just a few days ago, pointed questions about Iran and complicity with the JCPOA and this agreement. And he said point blank, we have inspectors and video on the ground constantly. They are in full compliance. Then the question was asked to him by Steny Hoyer, and so have you picked any undeclared sites and asked for access to them? And he said yes, and he said, what was the reaction in Iran? They opened the sites to us. So in terms of compliance, there is no evidence of noncompliance on the side of Iran. And that means they exported all this fissile material. They closed down the Iraq reactor. They did what they said they were going to do. And that makes a safer place in the Middle East for everyone, including the Israelis, even though they opposed our efforts in this direction. The second issue, I hope you saw Nick Kristof's piece. He's a great guy and a terrific writer and has a heart of gold. And he talked about worldwide famine and really zeroed in on Yemen because what the Saudis are doing with their blockade, he believes has created famine circumstances in that country. I didn't know about this letter by my 10 colleagues, and I certainly would join in it in a heartbeat. And if we have a chance to bring up a Saudi arms sale and condition it on some move toward resolving that conflict and lessening the human suffering, count me in. Okay? Right.
Hi, Senator. Thank you very much for holding this town hall because, as many residents in Bloomington know, we have had a very difficult time getting our congressmen to hold town halls here. So. My name is Sarah Keene, and I am a resident of Bloomington. And I just wanted to express my concern about our Twitter in chief and about the credibility that he has. Is there a concern in the Senate right now about his credibility and what damage he's doing to our country with the fact that he is tweeting things about North Korea and about places that really shouldn't be tweeted about?
I hate to quote myself, politicians would do that, right? But I said a couple weeks ago, he's destroying his presidential credibility 140 characters at a time. And I think what's even worse is that he is raising questions in people's minds about what you can believe. You know, it used to be that there was always a fringe that said, you can't believe anything you read in the newspapers or see on TV and all the rest of it. There was always a fringe. I think that is growing in size. And that really undermines a democracy. You know, we have to at least agree on some facts. And so we can engage in a meaningful and respectful debate. But if we can't even agree on facts or alternative facts, it's very difficult to sustain a democratic dialogue, a respectful democratic dialogue. But I worry about that. And you ask me about how we feel about him in Congress. I've never seen a president like this of either political party, never. And I will tell you, I'm concerned about some of the things he said, some of the tweets he sent, some of the policies. But my greatest concern, and I say this in all sincerity, my greatest concern is that knock on that presidential bedroom door at 3 in the morning where he's dozed off between tweets and somebody says, I'm sorry to wake you, Mr. President, but you have 5 minutes to make a life or death decision for the United States. That's what I'm worried about. Who will he call? Who will he turn to? Whose advice will he take? And what will be, sadly it may be, but that's the part that bothers me the most. He is not a person who likes to read. He's not a person with an inquisitive mind, and I just worry about what's going to happen in that circumstance. It's more than credibility. It's responsibility. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Senator. My name is Grant Walsh, and I'm not a doctor from Bloomington. My question, you kind of touched on a little bit, is dealing with the gun violence in Chicago. Previously, I've heard comments from you and from others talking about the number of guns that are trafficked in to Chicago from Indiana.
Yes.
And that, you know, you can go to an Indiana gun show, plop over your driver's license, and buy a gun and bring it back to Illinois. There's federal laws on the books to prevent that. It's against the law. You can't buy a gun in Indiana and bring it to Illinois. It has to be transferred to an FFL in Illinois. And I did some research going back all the way to George H.W. Bush, and very few presidents ever instruct the ATF to really crack down on those dealers who are illegally selling guns. And in this case, if the ATF, and the ATF has put these reports out saying, these Indiana dealers are selling these guns and they're coming back to Illinois. Why hasn't the ATF cracked down, and why hasn't any president instructed the ATF to crack down on these dealers who are illegally selling firearms because they are violating federal law?
Thank you, Grant. Federal licensed gun dealers have a requirement to do a background check. What we're talking about at gun shows are those who are not federal licensed dealers making sales, and there are no background checks required. It's the gun show loophole that they call it. So I asked the ATF what you just asked me. Well, why aren't you parked in the parking lot and taking a look at who's filling their trunk up with guns? And they said they wouldn't do it. And I thought to myself, why wouldn't you do it? Well, because the ATF is under constant pressure not to exercise its own powers by the folks who sell the guns. In fact, it is common for them to leave the head of the ATF operation vacant for months and years at a time so that it doesn't have the power that it should have and exercise. So I think that's part of the problem. We're not going to see that change under this administration. We're just not. But I hope we both agree. I think we agree, don't we? We don't want people who want to buy guns for criminal purposes to buy them anywhere and bring them into our state or any place for that matter, right? I mean, we both agree on that. And if you're saying the ATF should get tougher, I'm with you. But when I asked them point blank, they said, you know, we kind of hold back. We don't go as far as we can go. I wish they would. I wish they would. And I think it's because of the pressure they get from Congress, to be honest with you. Well, I got to get some names up here.
This is Sound Ideas, a broadcast of U.S. Senator Dick Durbin's town hall meeting in Bloomington, Illinois Wesleyan University. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to GLT.
Gene Mikulski? Mary Campbell. Looks like I picked some popular ones there. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Jill Blair. I live here in Bloomington. I'm going to throw two questions at you. Number one, are you interested in running for governor?
No. No. Got a full-time job,
please?
And I think it's pretty important.
Number two, what advice would you have for someone who is thinking about running or who is running for the first time, who's a newbie to all this? You know, what would you tell us how to handle that?
Good question, because I've got a lot of people asking me that question who are thinking about running for the first time. And that's encouraging to me, you know. I hope they do. Couple things I've learned, and they're kind of life lessons, maybe not political lessons. First time I ran for the state senate in Springfield, I was a young pup and didn't know what I was doing, running against an incumbent and so forth. And I sat down in my law office late at night, and I wrote down 10 names in Springfield, Illinois. I said, these are the 10 people I need on my side to be a successful candidate for the state senate. I'm going out to get them so that they're with me. And I call them, and I get fishy answers, or they wouldn't take my phone call. And so I just did it anyway, and I just went forward and did it anyway. And I put that sheet of paper in my desk, and a year later, when the campaign was over, and I almost won, campaign was over, I opened it, and I saw that sheet of paper. And I looked at those 10 names, and I thought, there were only four or five of them who ever did anything for me. The other five never helped me at all. Then I turned the paper over and wrote down the names of all the people I did not know when I announced my candidacy, who had done amazing, incredible things to help me. And that is the lesson in life. If you come to this with commitment and excitement and energy and knowledge and respectability, you're going to start drawing a crowd, not just people who want to hear you, but people who want to help you. So be sure of yourself, of what you want to do, why you're doing it, and, you know, move ahead. Don't wait for a permission slip. Don't wait for it. Just do what you think is right and move ahead. I lost three times before I ever won an election. I don't recommend that. But I learned something each time. I wore out the voters. They finally elected me. But, you know, the other thing is, if you've never done this before, get involved in somebody else's campaign and see what it's like, you know, and what you have to do and what you have to commit yourself. It's a big time commitment. And it's a big family commitment. I don't know your circumstances. But all these things you have to take into and calculate. You don't have to be super wealthy. You know, when I hear that one candidate in our state put $50 million into his campaign account, I'm thinking he didn't just put his thumb on the scale. He didn't put his hand on the scale. He set his fanny on that scale and said, come and get me. Well, guess what? I don't think money's going to buy this. I think when it comes to that election and many others, it takes a lot more. And I would rather have what Bernie Sanders had with his grassroots support across the United States. I'd rather have that than Mercer and the Koch brothers. So don't be discouraged. Go get them, okay? Thank you. Next person. We'll go way up top.
Hi, my name is Rebecca Fortner. I live in Carlock, and I'm a teacher at Bloomington High School. Product of public schools, teach at a public school. My kids go to public school. Very, very alarmed by the confirmation of Betsy DeVos. And I am wondering what you can do, what we can do to protect the public education for all our students, and in particular also to protect the education for our students with disabilities.
Yep. You won't be surprised that I voted against Betsy DeVos. And This is a classic example of someone who was chosen for the wrong reason. When they asked her whether her $200 million contributions to the Republican Party had anything to do with her cabinet position, she couldn't imagine that it did. Well, it turns out she is not prepared for this job, and she's proven it in the hearing. Lamar Alexander's a friend, but he reached the point where he had to protect her from questions. So he cut the question time down to 5 minutes per Democrat, and that's it, take it or leave it, and wouldn't let her appear a second time. And then she came in with a very bizarre understanding of historically black colleges, having something to do with school choice. I don't get. All we can do is to watch her and to make sure everyone is watching her decision-making in this process. And we have to be prepared to call her out when she does things which are inconsistent with the values of this country. And I'm afraid she's going to be headed in that direction. When it comes to students with disabilities, you just brought to mind one of the key questions we asked of Neil Gorsuch. There was a case, who would have believed this, in the middle of the hearing on Tuesday, the Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision, written by the Chief Justice, ends up overruling a case by Neil Gorsuch, his opinion. And what it came down to is an almost painful statement. Under the IDEA Act, students with disabilities are supposed to have access to public education, good public education. And what happens, of course, is that some of these students have special challenges, and the public school may not be able to meet the challenges. The parents then look for another setting. Sometimes they find it, and then it gets expensive, and they turn to the school district for reimbursement. The cases have been going on in this field for decades in terms of reimbursement. The standard that was used was more than de minimis education in terms of public education, more than de minimis. And Neil Gorsuch argued that was the standard of his 10th Circuit in writing a decision. But he added a word, merely. Merely more than de minimis. And I said to him, it's like saying if you have a hungry child, the law requires you to either provide more than de minimis food or merely more than de minimis food. The difference, profound. And the Supreme Court threw it out and said merely more than de minimis means no education at all. You're just waiting for that student to drop out. So we've made a commitment under IDEA, and I wouldn't be surprised if the Trump administration attacks that and DeVos attacks it. But it's worth a fight so that disabled students, whether profoundly disabled or seriously disabled or those with learning disabilities, have a fighting chance. How many times have I run into members of Congress who said, I now realize I was ADHD, you know, throughout my life. Just didn't know it, you know. Now I do. But we have made that commitment. We need to keep that commitment. Next. Who's next? Upstairs?
Are you going to hold it? She's going to hold it for me, which you have to hold it higher because I'm taller. Welcome to Bloomington Normal.
Thank you.
A lot of women in this audience went to Washington, went to Chicago, went to Champaign, went to Peoria. And it wasn't done for the moment. It was a movement. And what I'm asking is, what impact is this movement that's going on all across the country, actually pretty much around the world now, what impact is that having on both Democrats and Republicans alike in Washington, D.C.?
Well, I'll give you an honest answer. We're still waiting to determine whether this movement is the Occupy movement or the Tea Party movement. And there was a profound difference. The Occupy movement got a lot of attention and disappeared. The Tea Party movement got a lot of attention and stuck around and became a major political factor. What was the difference? They were engaged. They decided to start endorsing candidates, contributing to candidates, organizing for candidates, and that Freedom Caucus is a product of the Tea Party movement. So the question is whether the energy and emotion we feel at the grassroots level today is going to translate into real work for real candidates and real victories. I think it should, and I think it will. Say a word about the Women's March. I stayed home. We had 1,000 people in downtown Springfield who came out the same day. But the ones who went out to Washington and came back blurry-eyed the next day I said, where did you march? And they said, we couldn't march. There were so many people, we just kind of stood around and looked. I said, that's fine. That's good. That's all good. It was an amazing turnout, incredible turnout, almost as much as the inauguration.
I in no way want us to be compared to the Tea Party movement, so you'll have to come up with another comparison.
Okay, I'll work on it, okay? Who's next? Yes.
Hi, Senator. My name's Jean Mahalski. I live in Bloomington. From Senator Sessions, Jeff Sessions, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, he's recently come out very hard against marijuana, medical and recreational. In Illinois, a couple of bills have just been introduced for recreational marijuana. How far will people, congressmen, and go in for protecting states' rights to sell marijuana without them getting the federal government involved and putting people in jail?
Our marijuana laws now are a complete mess, trying to figure out where they are. You may have read about Maureen Dowd, who went out to Colorado when they decided that they would have recreational marijuana. And she said it was time for her to try marijuana. So she went and bought a bar of candy, marijuana, and went up to her hotel room, ate the bar of candy, passed out, hallucinated, woke up 18 hours later, and realized that she'd taken 8 pieces of the candy bar instead of 1. So let me get back to the serious side of this. When I was a kid lawyer in Springfield, more parents discovered the Bill of Rights when their kids were busted with pot than any other experience I could imagine. And they called me and said, isn't there something called due process here? Yes. So outrageous things were happening. People were being penalized and facing long-term negative impacts in their life because of childhood indiscretions with pot. Okay, that was ridiculous. Thank God it's come to an end, virtually come to an end everywhere. People went to prison over pot, and you all know that story as well as I do. Now comes the new world, the world of the state of Washington, the state of Colorado, maybe even the state of Illinois, and it is an undefined terrain about where we're headed. I do not believe for one minute that all the people that spent all the money to get all the licenses in Illinois were for medical marijuana. I don't believe it. They believe the day is coming for recreational marijuana nationwide. Meanwhile, the federal laws still keep marijuana in a classification where we cannot do research on its medical benefits. I think that's wrong. I think we ought to know. I believe that if there is a chemical in marijuana which can alleviate pain, deal with glaucoma, for goodness sake, shouldn't we know it? And if it is that chemical, whether it comes in pill form or whatever form, I have no problem with it being legally prescribed. But the federal laws, because of the classification of marijuana, make that impossible today. We've got to change that, I think. Next comes the whole question of regulation when it comes to the money involved in marijuana. They're dealing in cash because they can't take the proceeds into a bank without facing federal prosecution. So it's totally upside down. What do I expect from this administration and Jeff Sessions? Nothing good on the subject. I'm afraid when it's all over, it's going to be a more tangled mess than it is today. I just don't see them sorting it out. I got to get some names here.
This is Sound Ideas on GLT 89.1 and 103.5 FM. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're at a town hall meeting held by U.S. Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois at Illinois Wesleyan University.
Mel Haney. Sound right? Jody Slothauer. Joel Studebaker. Never owned one, but wish I did. And, oh man, these questions. You're going to get Jerry Green. And Victor Harris. Get on up here. Okay. Next. Who's next? Who's ready? You ready?
Hi, my name's Mel. I'm a super proud feminist. I have so many concerns, and it's really hard to think of one question because I'm really super concerned about everything right now, bathroom bills and abortion rights, but I'm going to focus on, do you think that we can pass the Equal Rights Amendment as a nationwide thing?
I was just a pup in the state Senate, lawyer, and I was working at the time when Esther Saperstein, was the sponsor of this, and she was fighting Phyllis Schlafly. They have both gone on to the great beyond. I'll let you decide where they've gone. And it was incredible. It was all about same-sex bathrooms and, you know, for goodness sakes, it's always about bathrooms, isn't it? It's long overdue. It should have been passed years ago. It's a simple statement of fact. If we don't agree on that as a country, we don't agree on equality. And we have to pass it. Now let me let you in on something which you ought to think about. Jeff Guerin's a pollster who took a look at the exit polls and asked the exit voters some questions after the November 8th election. Whole series of questions about why they voted the way they did. The last question he asked was this: do you believe that the United States is better or not better because of our diversity when it comes to race and gender and sexual orientation and the like? It was a great divide. Off this way go the Trump voters, off this way go the Clinton and Bernie voters. It is a divisive issue in our country at this moment. Diversity is. I embrace it. I think that's what makes us strong. But it is one of the key elements of that drove the electorate on the other side to vote for Trump. The diversity part worries them, scares them, whatever it does. I just tell you that by way of insight. That is a reality of what the polling showed. That doesn't diminish at all what I feel and probably you feel about the subject. But we've got to be thinking about this in positive terms of winning back some of these voters. And you say, win them back? Are you kidding me? 20% of the Trump voters voted for Obama. 20% of them. And many of them are still with us on a lot of things. They're turned off by this whole healthcare debate, by what Trump's position is on it. And they're starting to feel like they were betrayed. So we have to think in terms of the future as to, you know, what will bring these folks back into a position where they may be supportive of some candidates to come. Yes.
Hi. First of all, my name is Joel Studebaker, and I'm from Normal, Illinois. First of all, I want to thank you for offering positive responses to Republicans on healthcare in the form of public option and dealings on pharmaceutical companies. I think it's important that we're not just an opposition party to Trump, but that we also bring forward something that we can offer. On that note, I think that last year we certainly had a tough time as Democrats, and some people kind of experienced the primary like a bit of an identity crisis. And I think as we near elections again, I suspect that those feelings are going to reemerge, and that we're going to once again have to deal with some fundamental questions, not just about what we oppose from Republicans, but who are we fundamentally? And on that note, I feel like last year one of our crises was, are we a pragmatic party that responds to the questions of today? Or are we an aspirational party that has a vision for where we're going that we can offer to citizens and say, this is what we want? And so specifically on the issue of health care, where do you see Democrats going on the issue of single-payer health care, not necessarily as an issue to bring forth in today's Congress, as that probably wouldn't go very far, but for the future?
I think it is aspirational. But it's something I aspire to, and I think we will decide is the only reasonable outcome of what we face. But one of the points you made is really critical, and that is this whole pragmatic aspect of this. There are a lot of people out there who feel that this system has really been rotten and unfair and hasn't given them a chance, despite their best efforts and trying. And I think we have to address that. This whole trade debate really gets down to a feeling of, yes, there's going to be change, but what are you going to do about the victims of change? Do you bear any social responsibility to those victims to help them reestablish themselves for the sake, for their own pride and for their families. And I think we're learning the hard way that we have to. We have to make a commitment to stick with them to get them back into the mainstream of the economy and life. Too many times, a little trade adjustment assistance and they're gone. That just doesn't work anymore. And I think when it comes down to that, that the pragmatic side that you just talked about is our only way to reach back to some of those Trump voters who are looking for change that will give them a fighting chance. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Jody Slothauer, and I met you at the Remembering the Roosevelts dinner, and I'm running for Normal Township Clerk.
How you doing? Didn't you come out of an indivisible meeting?
Yes, yeah.
You know how many times I've told your story?
Thank you for telling that story on MSNBC. We have a group called Voices of Reason. A lot of people are there. Thank you very much.
How you doing? How's the campaign?
It's going good. Sarah Grammer, who's running for township supervisor, is here. Sally Pine is here. Joel is helping with the campaign. You know, we just sent money for a billboard, so you're going to see the billboard on Veterans Parkway. So we're inspired by you. Thank you. There's a couple of things that you haven't addressed so far. I guess as a writer, I'm going to just ask about the NEA and the NEH. I personally have benefited from those, so it's a lot of people in this room. I understand the culture wars. I don't really want to fight culture wars again, but I think that these... If we don't have great culture, great art, what are we doing this for? I mean, so my question to you is, how much are they on the chopping block, and what can we do, and where's that going?
If you're in the Bushwick section of Brooklyn, New York, on April the 9th, you can go to my daughter, the artist, show, which she's having, and understand where I come from on this issue. I want to tell you a little story. Let me tell you a story. It was a few years back. John Ashcroft, then a member of the Senate from Missouri, came to the floor and offered an amendment to defund the National Endowment for the Arts. The argument he made, this is for rich people and highbrows, and he represented common folks, working people, who wouldn't be found dead in an art museum, and they would rather see us spend money on a lot of other things, sports events and so forth. He went on and on about it. So I got up and said, I disagree with you completely. I told you about my mom earlier. I said, my mom, eighth grade education, immigrant lady, used to put me in that 55 Ford and take me across Eads Bridge over to the St. Louis Art Museum and walk around. She didn't know much about the artists, but she knew what she liked. And I was Joe. Joe, come here. Yeah. Look at that. Now just look at that. Now walk over to the other side of the room and look at it. It looks totally different. Thinking, my mom. And we did that over and over again. And I said, so she wasn't college educated, not even high school educated, but art meant something to her. And then I saw come on the floor Robert C. Byrd of West Virginia. And he came in there and he asked to be recognized. And he said, I want to talk about music. He says, I'm an adopted. I was an orphan, and I was adopted. And he said, I learned to play the fiddle when I was a little kid. And he said, it really changed my life. Music is important. Pretty soon, people are coming to the floor talking about art and music. Ashcroft then says, I ask unanimous consent to withdraw my defunding. And I said, I object. I object. I want to vote. We beat the schnockers out of him. The point I'm getting to is... It's not going to be a piece of cake, but it is a bipartisan issue when it comes to the arts and the humanities. I believe it's bipartisan, and I think we can restore a lot of it. But when you take $50 billion out of the non-defense budget, you start hurting a lot of things. This president would take $5.6 billion out of the National Institutes of Health, reducing biomedical research in America to the lowest level in 16 years. What is he thinking? Makes no sense whatsoever. So there's a battle on, and I think Republicans will join us in some of these. Thank you.
This is Sound Ideas, a broadcast of U.S. Senator Dick Durbin's town hall meeting at Illinois Wesleyan University. You're listening to 89.1 GLT on WGLT.org.
From the wall to the defense spending, everything he wants to spend, how realistic that they're going to appropriate the money for his programs?
Well, this fellow he has, Mulvaney, head of OMB, is a pretty tough cookie, and he's a slash and burn. I mean, he's the type of person who says, defaulting on the national debt, so what? You know, let's just do it. He did say that, and he's been for government shutdowns and things that most responsible people don't support. And he has produced his dream budget. It's actually Heritage Foundation's dream budget in terms of what they would like to see it look like, with $50 billion more. Well, no, back up, $30 billion this year, $50 billion next year into the Department of Defense. Guaranteed, they cannot absorb $80 billion without wasting a whole heck of a lot of it, at the expense of non-defense programs like Meals on Wheels. You know, it makes no sense for us to do this. So this, what happened today is the first indication to me that we may be able to sit down with some Republicans and chart a congressional course. The president had his chance today, and it didn't work out well. So now we may have... We may have a chance now for a bipartisan congressional course, which I hope we do. Thank you. Anybody else on the, anybody else up there? Hello. Hi. Okay. How are we doing on time? We got 10 minutes. Is this what Friday night is in Bloomington normally? Lauren Haney. Get on up here, Lauren. Dot Stockel? Dot Stockel, you're on. Deb Gentry? Deb Gentry. And one more, and then I'm going to wrap it up. Thomas Witt. Go.
I'm Lauren Haney. I am from Normal. As a former Planned Parenthood employee, I know firsthand how important and how vital and life-changing their services are. I want to know what we can do and what you're going to do to fight for, to make sure that men and women continue to have access to their services and that women continue to have safe and legal access to abortion without judgment and without restriction.
So this is it. If that bill, which was being considered in the House, had made it over to the Senate, we fully anticipated Susan Collins to offer an amendment on defunding Planned Parenthood and probably Lisa Murkowski and some others to join us in stripping that provision out. It shows that it's not going to get through the Senate, and for good reason. You probably know this, but many people may not. We have the lowest teenage pregnancy rates in 30 years. We have the lowest number of unplanned pregnancies in 30 years. Now, you may know my background, religious and political and all the rest of that. If you want to stop or decrease the incidence of abortion, reducing the number of teen pregnancies and unplanned pregnancies is clearly a logical step in doing that. So, We tried when it came to Roe to have Judge Gorsuch be explicit on it. He kind of walked around it a little bit, talked about it as a precedent and such. I read a section of a book he wrote, a doctoral thesis and book on euthanasia, and asked him if that applied to abortion. He said it didn't. That's as close as we got to a commitment there. I do believe that at this point Roe is not going to be overturned. And I do believe that after 44 years, we've established a basic standard on that. I think that is settled law in this country. Okay? Thank you.
Hi.
A Cub fan.
Go Cubbies. Go Cubs, go. Thank you for being here. I appreciate you taking your time and sharing it with us. Most everybody's asked all of my questions already. Thank you, everybody. But one item that we haven't touched on is the environment. and the dismantling of the Environmental Protection Agency, which is going on right now. The leaks in all of the pipelines that no one's talking about. What can we do? What can you do? And what are the chances that we can save the EPA and our environment?
I hope you're, I know you feel strongly, many do in the audience about this, and if you do, I hope you'll do your darndest to follow the speeches of Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, my colleague, who has really made this his cause. Hardly a day goes by that he doesn't come to the floor to talk about it. And when it was time to ask questions of Neil Gorsuch, he had an interesting line of questions. He noted that some 6 or 8 years ago, it was not uncommon for Republican senators to join in efforts to deal with global warming. It used to be the McCain-Lieberman bill that we would consider on dealing with global warming and climate change, and other Republican senators as well. And then something happened, and not a single senator, Republican senator, would touch the issue. What happened? Exactly. Citizens United, decided by the Supreme Court, put the Koch brothers in the driver's seat. And from that point forward, those who were supporting the petroleum industry basically told Republican senators, watch your back. If you come out on a pro-environment side, we're going to come and get you. And they did. And as a consequence now, there are few, if any, Republican senators who will even join in the conversation, let alone in the legislation, dealing with climate change. Now we have a president who doesn't believe in it. It's a Chinese hoax or whatever his latest rant is. And he proved it by sending us Scott Pruitt. I mean, here is an Oklahoma attorney general who was the bete noir of the EPA for years, and now he's in charge and proposing a 30% cutback in EPA activity. So we've got to get smart in the way we deal with this. And there's a lot at stake. One thing is, most people in the environmental community are now kind of coalescing around a narrative. And the narrative is clean drinking water. And you think, well, wait a minute, that doesn't cover the reefs, it doesn't cover greenhouse gas emissions and such. But what they're trying to do is to drive home the environmental issue in the most powerful way. And it turns out drinking water is the most powerful way. When you ask people all up and down the spectrum what worries you the most, it may not be the glaciers, but it is going to be, what's in that water? You know, is that safe to drink? Is it safe for my kids to drink? So saying that the EPA is losing its power and its determination to deal with clean drinking water makes a big difference. So I just suggest that to you as a way to approach it. Second thing is, I often remember the seatbelt laws, and some of you probably can't remember a time when you didn't have a seatbelt in your car, but I can. What the heck happened? How did we reach the point, except for that buzzer, how did we reach the point where we started using seatbelts? In the early days, you know what it was? It was your kid in the back seat. Dad, put on your seatbelt, right? Remember that? We need to really work on educating this next generation about what this is about so that they understand that what we're arguing about is not for us but for them. And they start building this into their life values to make sure. And I think they're there. They want to be there. And it means an educational effort that reaches out in their direction. So I hope we can work together on that. I worry about the EPA and what it means. It's, you know, when I take a look at the Great Lakes up there and the elimination of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, the elimination of it, I mean, that is heartbreaking. Anybody from Wrigleyville or any place north knows what that Lake Michigan means to us. Thank you. Okay. I like your T-shirt, man.
Thank you. Thank you. Senator, thanks again for being here. As the father of a 5-year-old brain cancer survivor, my wife and I went to bed terrified on November 8th, and we've spent that way. We've been in that state largely for the last few months. As far as the ACA goes, I know we've dodged a bullet today. Is there any chance that we can work with the sane Republicans and maybe try to mitigate some of the damage they've done over the last 8 years, you know, as far as stripping the money out of the risk corridors, just some of the technical things that they have done to throw sand in the gears and make Obamacare, the ACA, not work. It's like a bunch of arsonists are standing around complaining about the smell of smoke. They're unconscionable, and I don't know, are there any sane Republicans we can work with?
Well, in Congress? The answer is yes. The answer is yes. There are some in the House that showed extraordinary courage on this. Republicans. Charlie Dent, I was with him over a cup of coffee yesterday, and others like him. Sure, I think they would talk and try to work out some sort of way to move forward. You know a lot about this clearly. If you talk about risk corridors, it was Rubio who put an amendment we let slip by, our fault, damn it, that took away this reimbursement to insurance companies when they were dealing with risk pools that were, you know, awful, where enough healthy people didn't sign up. But it was also this president who sent out his first executive order, you know, shut them down any way you can when it comes to the Affordable Care Act, and did his best. It didn't work very well, but it did his best to diminish the advertising to get more people to buy into the insurance. So I'm not expecting him to give up overnight, but he, you know, one of the Republicans, was Lindsey Graham, said to me, he loves the art of the deal. Give him a deal. You know, let him say he made XY change, and we end up with what we need to keep moving forward and give people confidence it's going to be there for a while. I don't know what that is, what that change is. If it's a wall, it ain't going to work. But, I mean, the point is there could be some deal-making later on to change the Affordable Care Act in ways that might create some bipartisan support. But thank you for coming this evening. What do you have? One last? Are you the?
I think I'm the last one.
Good.
Deb Gentry from Normal. I have two gentlemen I'm sitting near who made their careers in agriculture. Agriculture is an important pursuit here in Illinois. What is your sense of the choice for our Secretary of Agriculture? And do you have some concerns for the direction that might take us?
I met him, Governor Perdue. Is his first name Roy? Do I have that right? Sonny. I should have. Sonny. Very personable fella who's had a background in the chemical business, agriculture chemical business. He understands agriculture in Georgia. When I mentioned ethanol, he said, I know that too. And he struck me as a person conversant in agricultural policy. He didn't say anything to me that I thought was radical in one direction or another. And then he left. And then the news stories started popping out about ethical problems he had as a governor of Georgia. And there are now a half dozen unanswered questions that are between me and making any kind of commitment to him. We found in so many of these cabinet nominees ethical issues that they had not resolved satisfactorily. For the record, and I know if you watch MSNBC or anything like it, you know this, that Penny Pritzker spent 6 months getting her financial records in order before she could be Secretary of Commerce. And she did it and without complaint. And it was a clear indication that if you have a lot of money or an interesting background, there's a lot of work to do. And clearly, he has to do that before he's going to be cleared for Secretary of Agriculture. Let me say one thing, because I got a reaction when I said chemicals here. I always struggled with that issue as to why there was such a wide gap between production agriculture and the environmental community. Almost, in some cases, an antagonistic view toward it. Because when you talk to farmers, particularly those who have been there for a generation, they talk in terms of stewardship and leaving it for their family and how much the land has meant to them in their lives. And that is really the energizing principle behind the environmental movement, too. The stewardship notion that we're only here for a short time. We've got to leave it as well or better than we found it. And there has always been a gap in the conversation here. And I've tried to bridge it. I tried to visit farms on Earth Day, for example, and let farmers tell me about their conservation techniques and how they were reducing the use of chemicals. If there's one thing that I think we can do and should do, and this is a perfect time to do it, is to start that conversation with farm organizations and environmental group. Trying to make some peace there and find some common ground really, really would be a positive thing for our nation. So let me end by saying thank you. You know, I'm going to have to tell those congressmen this wasn't so bad. So, in all seriousness, I hope they do come. And I hope that you give them a welcome, a warm welcome, for being brave enough to stand before an audience that may not be always on their side. And I hope that we can get back to a point where there is more dialogue. It is clear that most of this audience here is leaning a certain way. And I thank you for that. I thank you for giving me your time. But we really have to engage this nation in a better bipartisan dialogue about the challenges we face. That is part of what happened last November 8th. We're just going into warring camps instead of a dialogue which might find a way to bridge those differences. And there are many ways to bridge those differences. Thank you for caring. Thanks for being here.
That's U.S. Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois wrapping up a visit to Bloomington and Illinois Wesleyan University during this town hall meeting. Durbin took questions ranging from the Supreme Court and health care to education, immigration, the environment, and Russian meddling. I'm Charlie Schlenker. In going to Bloomington for the town hall meeting, Durbin is scoring political points with the progressive base that surged and became active since the election of President Trump. He clearly wants to offer support for non-party-affiliated progressives new to political life in a territory that has consistently voted for Republican congressional representatives. And he's in effect and explicitly putting his thumb in the eye of Congressman Rodney Davis and Darren LaHood, who have not held such meetings or expressed any interest in doing so. Thanks to broadcast technologist Travis Metters, Chief Announcer Laura Kennedy, Program Director Mike McCurdy, GLT News Director Willis Kern, and Illinois Wesleyan University for assisting in bringing you this exploration of the town hall meeting and the health care law situation. The GOP version of the health care bill was pulled earlier today. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is WGLT Normal News and Ideas. I've got a box of questions.